as we can see, as I'm doing.
Oh, all right, it is going, and then lovely. Oh, is that what? So if you just want to, then you should be able to just click.
Okay,
scroll like front back or whatever.
Is that what people see?
Yeah, they can see that.
Alrighty.
If you want to move them back into that folder.
Yeah, sorry. Megan does the tech part and I'm just here for the ride and I just have some extra things. So hello and welcome. I'm going to
Did it not work?
I don't know. Sorry, I'm trying to make the thing do the stuff and it's not doing the stuff. As we'll discuss, we're finding. I was going to say, word finding is a really fun side effect of being neurodivergent. So you'll probably get a great overview of what it's like, the lived experience. So hello, my name is Hannah, and I am talking to you today a little bit about understanding and implementing a neurodiverse affirming practice. So this is very much an introduction. So I know some people have different levels of knowledge, but I guess this was a nice introduction and base level for everyone to kind of get their head around it. So some of you might know things. I guess the layer that I was hoping to bring as well is the lived experience. So basically, in case you missed it, because I'm, always a bit frazzled, but basically I am neurodiverse, as is my daughter. So I am diagnosed with ADHD. In terms of my journey, that's been a late diagnosis, like most women that have sort of coming up with that neurodiverse kind of diagnosis of autism and ADHD. We're seeing a lot of women, particularly who are a little bit sort of a kind of 20s and 30s, even some 40s. Even one person I saw the other day. She's in her 60s, I think. So very much what we're seeing at the moment is a lot of women in later life getting diagnosed, and that includes myself. So I got diagnosed with ADHD. And my daughter, she likes to call it the triple threat. She's ADHD, she's autistic, and she's got dyslexia as well. So in terms of speaking from lived experience today, I'll be bringing my own lived experience. And the lived experience of a parent of a neurodivergent child, as well as an occupational therapist. So I work here at Sisu Therapies. It's my business, which is always very interesting, being neurodiverse and running your own business. Ultimately, it works better for me because I can be flexible, but certainly some challenges. So hopefully I can bring all three hats today and give you a little bit of an insight into that kind of thing. If at any stage you do want to ask a question, I think the chat's open. I'll do my best to make sure I respond to it. But let's kick off. So, like I said, nice introduction. So we're going right back to the start of what is. So let's start with what is neurodivergence. And one of the things I'll start off by saying is I have to try and do my best to remember the difference between neurodivergence and neurodivergent, which is a bit of a mouthful. Basically, when we're looking at neurodivergence, it's the whole spectrum of brain. So we use the term neurodivergent specifically when it's kind of outside the norm. And what we would say is most people are neurotypical. My brain really just did not want to say that yet. So I will do my best to remember the correct way of saying neurodivergent. But when we're talking about neurodivergence, it's the whole spectrum of all the brains, everybody's included. Neurodivergent is outside the norm, and kind of what we would say the majority of people is neurotypical. So I will rehash that as I go along. But that's always important to start off with because I know when I was first learning about neurodiverse affirming practice, it was one thing that I really had to get my head around because. We all use things interchangeably. But what we're going to talk about first is the neurodivergent umbrella. So, when we talk about neurodivergence, it refers to the natural variations in brain functions and cognitive processing that differ from our neurotypical majority way of thinking, learning, and experiencing the world. So many of you would probably know, given it sounds like we're all talking with professionals here who very much work in this space, a lot of autism and ADHD is kind of what makes up the majority of, I guess, our neurodivergent referrals. But what we've got in that as well is our learning disabilities. So dyslexia, dyscalculia, gosh, why are there so many long words today? Dyscalculia, dyspraxia. Those learning disabilities also fall into that spectrum. And then we also have some mental health variations. So PTSD, OCD, BPD, again, if it's not a long word, it's an acronym, all kind of fall into this range as well. And you're looking at things as well as Tourette syndrome. So when we look at the neurodivergent umbrella, it's quite wide. Most of the time when people are talking about neurodivergence or neurodivergence practice, usually it's autism and ADHD, but it is always good to keep in mind that there are other diagnoses under that spectrum. And I think as well, it's really important. People have probably seen in their practice as well. Often if you've got one, you've got a few sort of them combined as well. And sometimes it's not at the level which is maybe meets the criteria of a diagnosis, but it's always really important to remember that there's kind of sometimes these other flavors of diagnoses. So quite often learning disabilities might not meet a certain criteria to be diagnosed, but there are the difficulties there. And that's basically looking at your way you're processing language. Autism and ADHD, there is a bit of that shared stuff as well. Sometimes you might meet criteria not for others, but it's really important to keep in mind that even if there's not a formalized diagnosis, essentially there can still be traits. And it's important, and we'll talk about this more with the practice, to be looking at what the specific difficulties are for the person and targeting those. Oh, hang on, I just clicked my mind and not that one. Okay, so then, big mouthful, what is neurodiverse affirming practice? So we kind of touched on it, but basically it's about creating a world where everyone's unique brain is embraced, respected, and supported. So it's looking and understanding that there is a whole diversity of brains out there, and it's wonderful, and there's no right way of thinking or being. It's that everyone is different, and we all have these unique ways. And I think as well, the really nice thing that I like about this kind of move in society as general towards kind of being more neurodiverse affirming is we can see the strengths that these individuals can bring. And looking back as well, you know, when we think back at people like Einstein, you know, we can often reflect and be like, oh yeah, okay, that was a neurodivergent individual. So we've probably celebrated some of these people in the past, but I think they were people who maybe really, you know, I guess, like, for example, Einstein really came with something very heavy hitting and really made an impact on society. And what the lovely thing about neurodiverse affirming practice is that we can, as a society, and we as practitioners, can change the way that we engage with young people, but also engage the way and hopefully make the life in the world more accessible so that we then can have young people contribute. Sorry, I work with young people. We can have these individuals contribute to society. So really it's about breaking down barriers.
Oh, no, me, and it just clicked the like as if you're tapping.
Normal click. Ah, yay. Okay. So I thought when kind of presenting today, because a lot of us do know quite a bit about kind of neurodiverse practice, thought it might actually be nice to reflect on where it's come about from. I know that it seems like there's a lot of this stuff, particularly at the moment in the media, it's picking up steam. But really when I was sort of going, oh, you know, I might like to share a little bit about where this come from. It's been around since about the 1990s. So it's that move away from those traditional models of care. We know that. The thing I copied was not correct. But basically what we had is a lot of lived experience coming out. So a lot of the people who, I guess, are adults now who went through therapies like ABA, so Applied Behavioral Analysis Therapy, which is a very behavioral model, basically, a lot of individuals who went through that were able then to become adults and advocate for themselves. And what that was really a lot of these individuals coming out and saying, actually, this isn't a good way of us being. This is making our lives harder. We might be able to fit into the norm and look like we're, making eye contact and all this kind of thing. But in reality, we are just absolutely suffering. Like, it is a mask, it is exhausting. I feel like I'm not functioning as a human, despite the fact that I can, fit into the mold. So we had this really good lived experience coming out and saying, no, we're not doing things the right way. This doesn't fit for this diagnosis. So it was really lovely. And this sort of started being talked around sort of the 1990s. And really, we're looking at that kind of the disability rights activism, kind of that shift, I think, away from the medical model that all of us are experiencing. So I think that's sort of where it started as well. With autistic individuals as well, I think really sharing also the traumatic nature of ABA, and really the post-traumatic stress that that type of intervention causes. So that trauma-informed approach also helped kind of move this neurodivergence affirming practice along. Obviously, there's lots of wonderful research. Lots of people kind of just changing the paradigm, and it's that thing when you get a little bit of momentum and then people get on board, and now we're kind of at that stage where it's really going and really rolling. And so I think that's why, as practitioners, there's a lot more talk around it. And it might seem as well like there's a lot more people, like I mentioned in the media, like I know that, ADHD, TikTok, everyone's like, oh, everyone in TikTok has ADHD now. But really, what it is, it's, that we've got this momentum and people have access to tools to understand their own brains and to find out more about why they are the way they are. And we've got the fact that, people are talking about their experiences on social media, and that is connecting other people. So they go, oh my gosh, that's really like me. I experienced that. And then they do the research. So it really is a collective experience, and as everything progresses, it's certainly picked up momentum there. Yeah, that's a really good point. So sorry, we've got someone in the room who said, like a lot of, I feel like we've actually, we've moved from parents because our diagnostic tools have gotten better. We've got a lot of the young people, and I know certainly from my experience here, you'll be doing some assessments with a parent and they'll be like, oh, I do that. Do you think I have autism? And you're sort of going, oh, well, I can't diagnose you. And in your head, you're like, very much so. But, and then that's what happens. And then they're getting diagnosed, and then, they're talking to their parents. So now we've got grandparents and we're having a chat and we're being like, oh, I have autism. And grandparents are like, oh, do you? And then, you start listing off the things and they're like, that's not it. I just, that's just the way people do. It's like, no. And that's why we are sort of seeing even the older generation now, 60s, 70s, going back and realizing that they're autistic. And, it kind of, I think it's really nice that we're able to have these conversations. And it's nice that the older generations are getting on board, because I think there is a bit of that resistance too. I very cleverly cut off this slide. Sorry, I've moved away from my, oh, I'm still in that one. Yes, sorry. I've lost myself because I went on a bit of a ramble. Yeah, so this is the nice thing about having lived experience is you get these insights, but then you also have a presenter who goes off on a tangent and then can't find what slide she's on and all that kind of stuff. So there's certainly lots of wonderful things about being neurodivergent, but unfortunately with the ADHD, attention is not one of them. There's probably also a few spelling mistakes. So again, I just want to acknowledge that a lot of people probably know this. Sort of, we've touched on a lot of this, but I think it's really important to look at what are the core principles of neurodiverse affirming practice. Obviously, the first one, shocker, respect for neurodiversity. No one saw that one coming. So, very much, it's about that understanding that people are not here to be fixed. So, that's very much a shift. And I think on the next couple of slides, I do talk about what's a traditional model versus kind of, I guess, what's this different way of practicing. And it's about accepting and embracing diagnoses and really not kind of forcing people to fit into the mold. And following on from that strength-based approach, So what we're looking at is, if we're not fixing people, then how are we helping people to be the best selves that they can? And what it is looking at those individual abilities and creativity and problem solving skills. Like I said, I think, you know, the nice thing about this paradigm shift is we're able to look at neurodivergent individuals and say, okay, this is really hard for you, but what are you good at? And they do come with lots of really great ways of thinking and skills. And it's about harnessing those and helping them to use those particular set of skills that they have to overcome the challenges that they experience in their everyday life. And so very much, I guess, following on from that is, it's not a one size fits all. You know, even I think understanding, a growing understanding about autistic women, let's look at that, is that it's very different to the very classic kind of autistic diagnosis that we used to see. So if you're looking at representation in the media, you know, you have shows like The Big Bang Theory and we have Sheldon, and most of us can look at Sheldon and say, ah, yes, that is a very classic autistic individual. You know, it very much fits the mold of our diagnostic assessments, what our understanding is. It's the classic kind of diagnoses. Now, that's not what we understand all autistic individuals to be. And particularly with women, there is lots of differences, and some of those are social. So some of those is, you know, the way that women kind of, I guess, you know, their role in society, what we expect of young girls growing up. But also I think it's just a lot of the way that the brain expresses themselves. And even beyond that, obviously, then when we're looking at all people who are neurodivergent, we can understand that they're not that kind of very Sheldon box. You know, we have lots of beautiful creativity, and some people are really social. You know, it's very different. Some people, you know, that the struggle that they have with social skills is that they, you know, might be really rigid and they don't want to kind of socialize in a traditional manner. But other autistic individuals can. And, you know, if you're looking at that mix of particularly ADHD and autism, sometimes they're oversharers and they're going too much into things. So when we look at neurodivergent diagnoses, it's also important to remember that there is such a variety. And then that means when we're implementing our intervention plans, we have to really look at the individual, what their goals are. That's a really key part of neurodiverse affirming practice. And then looking at their strengths and what they want to do there. And really this, obviously, the next part is collaboration, because kind of goes on for there. And really helping people be able to advocate for themselves and to understand their diagnosis. Understand when they are masking or why people are different and how they're different. And I'm a really big advocate for education. Particularly, I love the brain. I could talk about the brain all day long. So being able to explain to neurodivergent individuals, I guess, those strengths and difficulties and why they exist, I think that can be really empowering. When we're also looking at it, you know, what we really want is for neurodivergent individuals to be able to participate in whatever they want to. So again, some might not want to socialize in a traditional kind of way, you know, what neurotypicals like to do. That doesn't mean they don't want to socialize at all. It just means they might have a different way of doing it. And so when we're looking at social engagement for neurodivergent individuals, it's about, okay, how would you like that to happen? You know, what are your terms when you are feeling really good and you've had a really good day? Like, for example, our young people on school holidays, what does that socialization look like for you? Versus when you're in school, you're really burnt out and you have no mental capacity, but you want to engage with your friends. What does that look like? So it's about them learning and challenging those barriers about, you know, this is what a neurotypical does and this is how you socialize. And if you don't do that, you don't want a social life. It's moving away from that to show that we can do different things and everyone has those different needs. This is a really lovely one that you can see lots of now, which is sensory and environmental accommodations. So these really lovely sensory rooms, which are very accessible now in public spaces. So I know, like with my own experience with my daughter, we went to the football at what used to be Suncorp Stadium. I don't know what it's called now. Suncorp Stadium is what we're going with. And they had a sensory friendly room. And we've had a really varied experience. Like, we've used the sensory friendly room at Dreamworld, which is just like a light. And that's pretty much it. It's dark. She still enjoyed it, but it's just like a dark room with a light in it. And you're like, oh, cool, that's it. Fair enough. But this one at Suncorp Stadium room, Brisbane, was really lovely. It had lots of space. It had these cool, like, little like holes in the wall, literally, where they could pull the curtains over, like little burrows. It had a beautiful, you know, bubble tube. It had these like game iPad things on the wall. But the part that I really loved is they actually had the game screening in the room. So as a parent, I could sit there and still watch the football. I wasn't missing out. I wasn't having to isolate myself because I have a child with certain sensory needs. My child could sit and have a great time watching the little bubbles. And it just meant that both of us were able to participate in this really lovely thing. And we were able to go to the football, which is a really huge sensory experience. You know, it's very noisy and loud and light, and you have to sit in your chair and it's uncomfortable. So for her, that's a really challenging thing, but she really likes the idea of coming and watching the football. You know, she thinks that's, you know, even if she doesn't actually like the football, she likes the idea. So both of us, and as a parent who wants to watch the game, we were able to participate with this one room being available to us, which is really wonderful. And so, yeah, so most spaces have them. Most public places, particularly like the theatres, you know, all the sporting stadiums, theme parks, they have them. So it's really great. It's very easy. Lots of the staff know about it, so you can kind of go, hey, where's this? And they'll be able to direct you. The other thing I will touch on, because this is kind of a little bit different from what I learned when I was in uni, is the difference in respect for identity and communication. So when I was in uni, they really hammered home this idea that it's a person with a disability, not a disabled person. Now, that's really respectful for a lot of people because they don't want to be defined by their disability. However, what we're hearing from neurodivergent individuals, particularly the autistic community, is that, no, I actually am an autistic person. That's how I want to identify myself. And so there's the beautiful analogy of autism's not a handbag. I don't hold on to it. It's not, you know, person with my autism. And then I come home and I put my autism down. It is part of them, and it's part of their way of thinking and being. I think, though, it's really important to add with that, though, with neurodiverse affirming practice, it's about the individual. So, for example, I have a client who doesn't want to be referred to as that. So it's about having the conversation. I said, hey, look, this is how I practice. This is the language I will use. Does that work? He goes, no, because I don't feel like my autism defines who I am. So I have autism. He has a very interesting relationship with his autism, but it's not something that I don't want to be part of that, like, I don't want to be autistic. I want to say I do this and autism is part of my life, but it's not all about me. So for him, the way that I'm practicing neurodiverse affirming practice, what a mouthful, is that I've listened to him and I've respected him. And I say, you know, person with autism. So even though we have these guidelines, it's really about remembering that it's the individual and meeting them where they're at. There we go. We've covered a lot of this, out with the old, in with the new. So we've really moved away from that medical view where everything needs to be kind of fixed, to recognizing that there are barriers that we need people to overcome so they can, you know, enjoy the most from their everyday life. It's moving away from, you know, those challenging behaviors to fit into what we consider normal, looking at autonomy and for people to look around and be able to have their own strategies that they can do and they can implement. That language, as I've just mentioned, we're looking away from a deficit-based language to kind of, you know, autistic individual, that ownership of your diagnosis in your brain. This kind of went out of whack there. Behavioral support and therapy. We've had a lot of that ABA, that applied behavioral analysis. It's not as big here. I think it is still in the system, particularly when you're looking at NDIS, and I'll kind of come to that, but it's very big in America. So, and you know, I guess that's the other really important thing is, you know, like with any therapy, there's a cultural context. So in America, they have a different health system from us, and a lot of their insurance, which, you know, to be insured and to be able to receive treatment, a lot of the insurance says you have to go through ABA therapy. So it's really difficult for a lot of individuals to access non-ABA therapy because it's still kind of seen as sometimes the gold standard. And we're trying to really be like, no, that's not what it is. And I think the really difficult part in the Australian context with NDIS is we're seeing this move towards behaviour support practitioners. And I've seen some behaviour support practitioners who are very much like, no, we do not practice ABA. That's not how we work. But because of the way it's sort of set up and NDIS, some things are restricted and other things are not. It's not like a blanket thing. It's not that kind of like we will or won't practice this. Obviously, there are guidelines, but I know that it can be a bit of a minefield for parents as well. So I think it's just important to acknowledge that we do have behaviour support practitioners, and some of them might align with the way that we want to practice, and others might, you know, I guess, work in more of an ABA model. And so it's really important as support staff and health practitioners that we talk to the family about that. And I guess thinking about families and how hard it is to have a neurodivergent individual, the last thing we want is us telling them one thing and another practitioner coming and telling them something completely different. So it's really important that we understand where all the other team members are coming from, their practice, and talking to parents about that and working out how we can all coexist and, I guess, looking at what the family wants and the family's needs are. All right, some other things that I would like you to know. That's amazing. One of the things that the autistic community is really clear about is they know that we have diagnostic levels, but diagnostic levels are not great. So with autism, we've got autism level 1, 2, 3. And the problem with that is some days people fit into the category really nicely of autism level 1, and other days they're on a 3. So if a person has lots of energy, they've had really nice sensory experiences, they've kind of had their cup filled, they might be functioning around, you know, what we would say is autism level 1. However, if their things are going badly and they've just got overstressed and overwhelmed, if they've got chronic health conditions and those are really flared up, they might be nonverbal and not able to leave the house and looking more like a level 3. And that's the problem as well with autism levels. And we know as well, like looking again at our context, NDIS is kind of like, well, it's a level 2 and beyond. Now, that's one of the challenges my family faces is my daughter is a level 1, which I don't think I've ever been upset to get a diagnosis. I'm like, can't we just get her over to a 2? Because she presents lovely and very well, and she masks a lot at school. So when they were doing the teacher assessments, the teachers were scoring her a little bit, I guess, not at a level of functioning that I see at home. And so there was a big discrepancy. This happened originally, so she got her ADHD diagnosis first, and then about a year later I sort of was like, no, something else is going on, and the pediatrician was like, well, you need to go get assessment, which is what we did. We were really lucky when she was getting diagnosed with ADHD because she was with a clinical psychologist who was doing WISC. She was doing a WISC. There we go. I got it. So she was doing the cognitive assessment. And as part of that as well, they did a CONAS, which is our really standard ADHD assessment. You give one to the parent, you give one to the school, you come back and you have a look. So even in that first circumstance, I filled out mine, the school filled out theirs, and it came back to the practitioner and she said, oh, wow, it's quite different. But because she was doing that cognitive assessment with my child, she's like, oh, I can see the difference. And she said, you know, I know you're an OT. I know you work in this field. So I don't feel like you hamming up the symptoms to get a diagnosis. She's like, I can see what's going on. And it was really great because it meant that we got that diagnosis. And I worry for other parents. Oh, it came up with a little low battery thing. Other parents where they might have had the experience with a different practitioner who said, no, look at this discrepancy, it's your parenting, which is something that has happened before. So very much we need to be mindful of how young people experience the world day to day, what they're like in the school environment, what they're like at home. I mean, some young people, it's completely different, and the school is just such an overwhelming experience that they're dysregulated all day, and then they might be very different at home. So what we're looking at is differences in environment and what that can look like. But yes, lots of our young people do mask, and so we do see a lot of that as a problem, that you will have this, you know, very different presentation. So she's autism level one, which means that we don't get the magical NDIS package. Yes, we can do a functional capacity assessment. Do I have the energy to do that? No, not yet. I'll do it someday. It's on the list, because we do have ADHD and dyslexia. And this is the other thing that's really important to mention, is a learning disability is not a disability according to NDIS. Don't know how that works. So even though she's got the beautiful triple threat, we don't actually qualify technically. So that's a funds log. So it's really important to remember with the families that, again, while we do have this wonderful system where we can access help for our neurodivergent individuals, not everyone kind of qualifies. And the other thing, which I talk about a little bit later, oh, there you go, I talk about it next. Ha ha, diagnostic is a privilege. It's really expensive. It's a horrendously expensive assessment. And, you know, you're looking at least $1,500 a lot of the time upwards. We know that this is because it takes a lot of time. So a lot of us working in the field understand where that money goes. But for a family, even getting in the door and getting that started can be incredibly difficult. So, you know, if you get the early intervention, things like that, but even then assessment's not covered. So what we have is a lot of families trying to navigate these incredibly difficult experiences where they're trying to get a diagnosis for the child, but financially it's incredibly hard. And you're also looking at as well, practical barriers for families is not only the financial side, even if they've got, let's say, an NDIS package, and so that's not as much of a burden. You have things like time. You have to take time off. You have to go, you know, take your child to appointments. Often if they have siblings, you've got multiple kids in therapy. There is a day-to-day cost with that. And that can be, again, one of the challenges that I think we need to just acknowledge when we're working with families. And again, as we said, often the parents are neurodivergent as well, so they've got their own struggles. So part, I guess, of the neurodiverse, I'll get it, affirming practice is thinking about the context of not only the individual, but the family, and then also the wider social kind of context as well, which, again, I think based on kind of who's here and who's listening, we are all very aware of that. But it's incredibly important that we understand that in the context of neurodivergent affirming practice. And I guess as well, we have to accept, I guess, particularly for, when I say older people, I just mean 18 plus, sometimes that self-diagnosis has to be valid, particularly if I've got some sort of older clients. Again, 18 plus is what I'm saying for older here. They don't want to look at medication, but they know they probably have ADHD, and it still costs a lot of money to get diagnosed. And you kind of have people looking at, well, do I want to spring thousands of dollars to have a piece of paper? In some cases, some people find that incredibly validating, or they do want to look at medication, and that's a really good experience for them. Other people, they'll sort of go, look, they might do a little bit of assessments, they might look at that, and they say, I kind of feel like I know I have the diagnosis, and I feel like knowing that I can put in strategies, and just that understanding is enough. So we really have to respect where people are coming from, and I know sometimes it's hard to sort of, you know, when people are self-diagnosing, it can be a little bit, you're like, oh, that's not always the greatest. But the reality is that sometimes we have to accept that those individuals might not be coming with an official diagnosis. And again, we're working with them where they're at. Oh, yeah, this is some things to know. Please don't tell me to use a sticker chart on my child. We've tried so many sticker charts. Sometimes I get really inspired and I think maybe this will be the sticker chart that gets us over the line. It's never the sticker chart that gets us over the line. And that, I guess, is the funny thing about cognitive behavior therapy as well. She has had quite a bit of therapy. I now say when we're trying to find a therapist, please don't do CBT with her. She's had it. She doesn't like it. I don't like it. It's painful for everyone involved. And the reason that it works, and I think this is important to say, and again, that doesn't mean that sticker charts won't work on everyone, just my kid. And the feedback is a lot of neurodivergent kids actually struggle with sticker charts. For my family, what it is the reward that my child wants is never as great as the difficulty she's experiencing. So for our particular family, school refusal is huge. And so what that's about is dyslexia for her. She's now going into grade 3 and she's caught up now to a grade 2 level in reading, which is fantastic because there was a long time she was not anywhere near her peers. And when you're looking at dyslexia, obviously reading and writing, huge part of primary school, that's off the table. She really couldn't do that. But then you also have other skills based on that. So maths, so she reads numbers backwards. So her maths is quite often off. You know, you're looking at science and music and things like that. They still have written components. So even though she has this really great interest in science, that participation was really hampered for her. So she hated school. It was tired. She didn't like talking to people. You know, she's either talking ear to ear or she doesn't want a bar of you. So for her, that experience was just overwhelming. And it didn't matter what sticker we had, what reward we had, she didn't want to go. And to the point I had to explain to a health professional, one time I took her to Toy World, one of the toy shops. I said, if you do this thing, I think it was something about going to school, you can have anything in this toy shop, anything at all. There's no limit. And she still wouldn't do it. So we need to remember that with the brains that are wired differently, we need to have different interventions. And look, I have so many planners. I went to a PD about helping adults with ADHD and they said, use a planner. Like, oh my goodness, no. If planners solved the problem, we wouldn't have a problem. So it's really about finding the strategies that work for you, and that's kind of what I've been doing myself. And that's why I am an advocate for diagnosis, even if it's people finding out about themselves, because I think once you understand why your brain is the way it is, you understand very much that it's not just about you. There's not something wrong with you, which I think is what lots of people have been told their whole life is, you know, this is just you. But you understand that it's not you. It's the way your brain works, and your brain has different strengths, and you need to, like, you know, for lack of a better word, you need to hack your brain. And that's kind of what I think a lot of our treatment needs to be about. There should be a buy one, get one free diagnosis. I kind of touched on this, but usually if someone's getting their child diagnosed, they sort of go, oh, that's me, or oh, that sounds a lot like my partner. And there's a reason for that. Also, I wanted to add here, don't use the puzzle piece. So that's, again, feedback from the autistic community that they don't like that symbol. Again, some autistic people do, so it's not a, you know, all for one, one for all, I don't know. It's not a overarching thing, but the feedback that the autistic community have given us is they don't feel like it's this bit missing from them, or they don't feel like it's, you know, I guess it's more that idea again of conforming. It's like, oh, you know, we're going to get you and put you together in this thing, and or, you know, you're like a puzzle piece that doesn't fit. It's not a nice analogy. And so they've really sort of said, hey, we don't actually like that. So a lot of you would have seen, and it would have been clever for me to put it in, but I didn't think that far ahead. The infinity symbol is kind of what we've got now. And it's this beautiful, like, inclusivity of all brains and the way we think. And so that's kind of what we're looking at. So when I present PD, my hope is that you can take something away and implement strategy tomorrow. So what I've popped in here is, let's look at what we can do tomorrow to make your practice more neurodiverse affirming. And this is also for people, I guess. I'm talking to health practitioners mostly here, but doesn't matter whether you're a parent that watches this later, if you're a teacher, whatever it is, these are strategies that you can use to make more neurodiverse affirming practice for everybody. So being neurodiverse friendly means, I think, you know, having that sensory adaptation. So here we have we're lucky enough to have a sensory room that's really lovely, but even basic things like having fidgets. And this is what I really love. Lots of schools and teachers have kind of different sensory modalities so people can engage. And, you know, it's something as simple as a fidget actually really helps. And I know when I was doing a lot of more practice in the community, I had a little fidget on my keys, so that way if a young person was meeting me for the first time, they're a bit nervous, or we had to go do something that was a bit anxiety provoking, I would just take my fidget off, my keys, and I'd give it to them. And that was great because it was this little tiny thing and it helped them participate because they had their sensory needs met. But I think as well that idea that, you know, anyone can have this stuff, it was really practical. And also I was thinking about their needs. And I think in a world that's not necessarily set up for neurodivergent people, being able to see that you are being thought of and wanting, you know, we want your input, it's a very big and loud message. Be creative and adaptable. Look, there's lots of things, you know, look at telehealth and gaming options. One of the most wonderful things we've started doing here, which I absolutely love, is a Dungeons and Dragons group. Now, I don't even think a year ago I knew what I knew what it was, but I certainly did never look at Dungeons and Dragons. It's not something that I think would interest me otherwise, but I started running it with neurodivergent individuals, and pretty sure if you play Dungeons and Dragons, you just get a bonus diagnosis, unfortunately. But the difference in the young people, really introverted young people, all of a sudden, just so different and engaging. And, you know, when we were looking at those therapy goals of, you know, communication, executive functioning, how they plan and work together, it was this incredible experience where I was like, oh, this is amazing. This is so much better than I could have ever planned a session. So again, it's about what can we use creatively to help neurodivergent individuals really meet their own goals? So learning about their interests, allowing neurodivergent individuals to what we call info dump. So quite often they might have an area of interest of their own, and it can be really, really lovely just to let them talk about it for ages, particularly as a rapport building tool. So I know, again, in my own experience, if you, I have a lovely individual who just wasn't having a great time. And so whenever they get really low, I ask them about, I think the bugs is kind of their special interest. So I'll try and think of a bug. And sometimes I try and think of a fun fact for the session. I'm like, hey, I learned this, you know, and I'll let them go on a tangent and info dump about it. And when you listen to it, it was really cool. I learned so much about bugs, which not my interest area. And at the end, they were like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I just talked about this. I said, no, I learned lots of that. It was really cool. I really liked it. And he said, oh, you know, I just, it's always really hard. I don't know if I'm dumping. I said, no, but I was asking questions. And so we were able to talk about, I guess, when someone is really interested in your topic. And that's the thing, you just ask a couple of questions and they'll be so excited. You know, I think giving them that opportunity to just express their needs the way that they want, it's incredible for rapport. So a little bit goes a long way. Understand things like situational mutism, which we used to call selective mutism. Again, it's that shift in the community. So there are some times when people can't communicate. How can we find different ways for them to communicate? And very much it's about the young person, well, sorry, again, the individual. But also not forcing things, you know, you have to get comfortable with silence as well. Like, is it about you or is it about them? And I think lots of us feel the need to fill the void with silence. It's okay not to do that. Focus on safety first and building that relationship. Because the other thing that's really key with neurodivergence, sorry, neurodiverse affirming practice, is that often these individuals have been navigating a world that is not friendly and accepting. So it's really common for them to be quite wary, and rightfully so. You know, you've had lots of invalidating experiences. So showing somebody that you're there and you will be persistent and consistent is really important. I don't force people to make eye contact with me. If young people come in, I sort of off the bat, as part of my practice now, I say, this is how I work, this is me being affirming, so I won't ever make you do eye contact unless you want to. You can stare out the window, I don't mind. You can fidget, whatever it is that you need to communicate with me and you need to feel comfortable here, we'll go with that. And again, it's that really lovely choice. Understand what virtue signaling is. So when people say they're neurodiverse affirming practice and they're not, it's really frustrating. And I think I put in the last one, call in or call out. If someone thinks they're maybe doing neurodiverse affirming practice and you can see that they're really not hitting the mark, calling in is this nice term where you kind of take them aside or you have a private conversation. You say, hey, I'm just not sure if you know this is not actually neurodiverse affirming practice and this is, maybe giving them the tools. So it's that idea of having a conversation in private so you're not triggering someone, in this huge arena where you're like, oh, you're not doing this and they can get defensive. It's a nice way of inviting people to have that conversation in a non-triggering way. Sometimes you do need to call out and you need to be like, that's not correct and that's not, what we're doing or that's not what it's about. But I like this concept of calling in. I really appreciate that. I think that's a nice way to go about it. Because a lot of the time people are usually trying to do the right thing and they might not quite hit the mark, but if they're trying, I think this is the way to, keep encouraging it. And helping with that diagnostic process, even if it's just directing people to where they can find more information. I've kind of gone through this, I won't go too much, but challenges as a parent, that Vyvanse shortage, oof, that was killing me there for a while. So understanding that parents might not have access to medication at all times. The fun people saying melatonin is addictive. My child doesn't go to sleep. She'll be up at 11 o'clock quite easily. She just does not have that switch in her brain. So I know I've done lots of research on melatonin. She just won't sleep, and that's not functional for school. So as a parent, I had to make that choice. She now doesn't want to take it, which is another challenge, but that's, yeah. Therapy, obviously old-fashioned views as well. She should just do this. Fit into the mold. Very frustrating being a parent and a therapist that works in a different way. Therapy is expensive. It's so expensive. Be aware that it is like $200 a session. And, when my daughter was doing OT fortnightly and speech fortnightly and then seeing a pediatrician, you're almost out of grand a month, and that is not affordable. We're both neurodivergent, so there are times when I will do some silly things. We get zoomies at night because I also get, for some reason, hyped up at night and my poor husband is in the background trying to calm us both down, and we're just being silly. It's tough. It's tough because you have different needs and they have different needs, and being a parent is hard on a good day. So I think it's that coming with empathy. And we were talking as well, just amongst ourselves, about the practicalities of parents. Megan was sharing some training that she did, and in it they said, really need to emphasize self-care to parents. I was like, oh, thanks, yeah. Shocker there. What I think it is when we're thinking about engaging with parents of a neurodivergent individual and we know that they're neurodivergent, we need to apply the same strategies. So breaking it down, I said, this is really important. It's like, where do you have time for self-care? What are you going to do? In the way that we would help maybe another individual, we can help that parent. So we're not just saying, oh yeah, go do self-care. It's like, oh, what do you like doing? Have you got time for that? Helping guide them through. So we understand that there are some executive function difficulties potentially with our client. Their parent might also have those. So keep that in mind. I did a few little quotes from my daughter. It's so difficult reading them sometimes. She said, this was in grade one, absolutely broke my heart. Sometimes when I'm at school, I feel like a dandelion and everyone else is a sunflower. And then we spent all this time talking about how great dandelions are because you make wishes on them. But she was really young and she knew that she was quite different. Again, from school, I don't know. I said, what did they learn about? I don't know. I was just focusing on not moving. I wasn't paying attention. I was like, don't move, don't move, don't move. Again, I've got done move. Oh, there we go. very much her experience, she's only grade three now, so you can tell the insight these kids have very quickly. She's changed this one, which is nice. She said, I said, she's like, I'm weird. I'm like, oh, it's nice being weird. She said, I don't want to be a weirdo. You can be a weirdo. I want to be like everyone else. She's changed a little bit now and that she's like, oh, I'm unique. I actually like this, which is amazing. It's so lovely. So now she kind of approaches this. I have dyslexia, so I'm really creative. And it was really cute. She saw another kid's this in prep. She goes, I know what it's like to have trouble signing. So I said, good job on your scribble. It was so cute. And then, yeah, this kind of coming, I've decided it's okay to be different. Everyone else is the same. I'm unique. And that means I won't be boring. So really, really lovely messages from her. straight from the horse's mouth. Last but not least, and I threw this in, please go and have a look at these concepts. Things like the double empathy problem. Oh, I wish I had time to go into that, but just Google it. It explains it very quickly. Basically, oh, I love them. Like, I'm not going to go into it. And then I say, it's the idea that we say, or I guess society says, neurodivergent individuals don't have empathy. And then what basically the problem is neurotypical people are not understanding that they show empathy in different ways. So neurodivergent individuals do have empathy. The way that they understand it is just different, and the way they show it is different. So if neurotypical people are saying they don't have empathy, that's actually them not having empathy for other people's needs. Masking, we kind of addressed that. The need to mask, the energy toll that takes, the huge overlap with the LGBTQIA plus population. If you want to be neurodivergent affirming, you have to learn about LGBTQIA plus affirming practice. Interception, which is about kind of the way we feel things in our bodies, the signals we get. Very, very difficult difficulties with interception and neurodivergent individuals. And feelings are often in our body. I heard a really nice feelings are called feelings because we feel them in our body. So if you can't read your body signals, understanding what your body is telling you and your feelings is really difficult. So interception, really important to understand. And spoon theory, I won't go into that. Basically, it's about energy and how much it takes. So those are certainly some things I would have a look at. I've got some social media people up there. That is not everyone, but there's some really good ones to start with. Yeah, I've kind of said this. I've got some extra books for the kids. I love, my daughter loves, My Brain is a Race Car. The Rainbow Brain is really beautiful. But also, yeah, I think it's just about me learning the way I am and how to use that. I'm very lucky I'm an OT because I feel like that is really helpful. Also, we have a sunflower lanyard. So the sunflower is the sign for invisible disabilities. Lots of places have these little lanyards. And it's really nice because I pop it up my daughter and she's like, what's this? I'm like, well, it's just to let people know you have different needs. And she's like, ah, yes. And so if she's in a line getting a bit wiggly, and I don't know, I think then the kid was like, what's your sunflower thing? And she's like, it's because I'm dyslexic. And I was like, that's close enough. But it's nice we have more of this acceptance. So I kind of, you know, if we're in a place where I'm like, okay, we probably need people to be a little bit more patient, it's a nice signal for other people about why, you know, she might need some extra time. I know that was a lot of information very quickly. That's the problem with this topic. Hopefully I gave you something different from what you'd heard. It's very hard doing an introduction on a topic that people probably know lots about. But I'm just going to see if there are any questions. Please feel free to talk. But also, as I said, you know, not everyone wants to pop up on the screen, so you can also do the chat. Megan has to do the very fancy thing where she makes the chat come up for me. No, that's okay. I'm really happy to do that. If anyone has any questions about anything. Oh, yeah, we'll stop sharing so you can ask.
Stop recording.
Oh, I thought that's, no, that's okay. Sorry. We'll stop recording so then you don't have to.